Part 6. Quietus. I've seen a greater share of wonders, vast and small, than most have done. My peace is made, my breathing slows. I could not ask for more. To reach beyond the stuff of day to day is worth this life of mine. Our kind is meant to search and seek among the outer bounds, and when we land upon a distant shore, to seek another, yet farther still. Enough. The silence grows. My strength has fled, and soul become a faded gleam. And now I wait. A Viking laid to rest atop his ship, though fire won't send me off, but cold and ice. And forever shall I drift alone. No king of old had such a stately bier, adorned with medals dark and gray, nor such a hoard of gems to grace his somber tomb. I check my straps. I cross my arms, prepare myself to once again venture into the unknown, content to face my end and pass beyond this mortal realm, content to hold and wait, and here to sleep in a sea of stars. The Farthest Shore, line 48 to line 70, Harrow Glancer. Chapter 1. Recognition. 1. She was. How, where, and what she could not say. But she was. The lack of knowledge did not bother her. She existed, and existence was its own satisfaction. Her awareness was a thin, trembling sensation, as if she were stretched over too much area. She felt insubstantial, a haze of recognition drifting across a darkling sea. And for a time, that was enough. Then she noticed the membrane of herself beginning to thicken, slowly at first, but with increasing speed. With it came the question that birthed all questions. Why? As her flesh continued to solidify, her thoughts also grew stronger, more consistent. Still, confusion dominated. What was happening? Was she supposed to know? Where was she? Was where something real or something she had imagined? The shock of connecting nerves caused her a stab of pain, sharp-edged as the light that shone upon her. For there was light now, from many sources. Cold sparks set in black and a great blazing sphere that burned without end. More shocks followed, and even thought failed before the barrage of pain. Throughout, she continued to increase in size, gathering, coalescing into being. A memory returned to her, and with it, the memory of memories. Sitting in third-year anatomy class, listening to the damn pseudo-intelligence drone on about the internal structure of the pancreas, looking at the glistening red hair of the undergraduate two rows ahead of him. What did it mean? What? More memories. Chasing Istha through rows of tomato plants in the greenhouse behind their habdome. Then diving past her coforms toward the abyssal plain, swirling around the overgrown lamp lines with the gasping beaks, arguing with his uncle who didn't want him to join the UMC, while she sat for entrance exams with the Lopsang Corp and entered the nest of transference before assuming her new form, and took the oath of fealty by light of Epsilon Indy on Concertina Racing Forms House Smat Double Shot Class 4-point verification near St. Heresy with the swirling exhaust of... Had she, he, it a mouth, they would have screamed. All sense of identity vanished within the tsunami of images, smells, flavors, and feelings. None of it made sense, and every part of it felt like them was them. Fear choked her, him, it, and they flailed, lost. Among the memories, one set was more lucid and organized than the rest. Greenery mixed with love and loneliness, and long nights spent working on alien planets. And she, he, it, clung to it like a lifeline in a storm. From it, they attempted to construct a sense of self. It wasn't easy. Then, from somewhere in the howling confusion, a single word surfaced, and she, he, it, heard it spoken in a voice not their own. Kira. Kira. The name rang like a struck bell. She wrapped herself in it, using it as armor to defend her core. using it as a way to give her, him, it some sense of internal consistency. Without that consistency, she was no one. Just a collection of disparate urges devoid of meaning or narrative. So she held to the name with a fierce grip, trying to maintain a semblance of individuality amid the ongoing madness. Who Kira might be wasn't a question she could answer yet. But if nothing else, the name was a fixed point she could center herself on while she tried to figure out how exactly to define herself. 2. Time progressed in strange fits and starts. She couldn't tell if moments were passing or eons. Her flesh continued to expand, as if precipitating out of a cloud of vapor, building, bunching, becoming. Limbs, she felt, and organs, too. Blistering heat, and in shadows sharp and stark, brittle cold. Her skin thickened in response, forming armor sufficient to protect even the most delicate of tissues. Her gaze remained turned inward for most of the time. A chorus of competing voices continued to rage through her mind, each fragment struggling for dominance. Sometimes it seemed her name was actually Kar. Other times, Quan. But always her sense of self returned to Kira. That was the one voice loud enough to hold its own with the others. The one voice soothing enough to calm their frenzied howls and ease their distress. Larger she grew, and then larger still, until at last there was no more material to add to her flesh. Her size was set, although she could change its arrangement at will. Whatever felt wrong or out of place was hers to move or mold as she wished. Her mind began to settle, and the shape of things began to make more sense. She remembered something of her life on Wayland long ago. She remembered working as a xenobiologist and meeting Alan. Dear Alan. And then, later, finding the seed on Adrastea. And yet she also remembered being Kar, Julian Aldous Kar, doctor in the UMCN, son of two not-so-loving parents and avid collector of carved barrel nuts. Likewise, she remembered being the Renawi Quan, loyal servant of the Knot of Mines, member of the Strike Shoal Hafar, and ravenous eater of the delicious Pfennig. But the memories from both Kar and Quan were hazy, incomplete, overridden by the far more vivid recollections of their time spent joined together in hungry fashion as the Maw. A shiver ran through her flesh. The Maw. With that thought, more information rushed into her mind, full of pain and anger and the torment of unfulfilled expectations. How was it she and they were still alive? 3. At long last, she turned her attention to her surroundings. She hung in the void, seemingly without motion. No debris surrounded her, no gas or dust or other remnants. She was alone. Her body was dark and crusted, like the surface of an asteroid. The fibers of the seed bound her together, but she was more than just the fibers. She was flesh, too, soft and vulnerable within. The eyes she had now grown allowed her to see the bands of magnetic force throughout the system. Visible also was the shimmery haze of the solar wind. The sun that illuminated all was a dim blue-white light that reminded her of... She didn't know, but it felt familiar, nostalgic. Though the nostalgia came not from her, Kar Quan, but from the seed itself. She extended her gaze. Scores of glittering ships populated the system. Some she seemed to recognize. Others were unfamiliar but of a familiar type, vessels belonging to graspers or else to two forms, or else to the misplaced flesh of the Maw, which was her. She was responsible. And she saw how the flesh of her flesh had resumed attacking the other ships, spreading pain, death, and destruction throughout the system. She did not understand the situation, not fully. But she knew that this was wrong. So she called to her wayward children, summoning them to her side that she might end the conflict. Some obeyed. They flew toward her with great banners of flame streaming from their engines, and when they arrived, she clasped them close and healed their hurts, calmed their minds, returned their flesh to whence it came. For she was their mother, and it was her duty to care for them. Some rebelled, though she sent parts of herself racing after, and so caught them and chastised them and carried them back to where she hung waiting. None escaped. She did not hate her children for misbehaving. No, rather she felt sorrow for them and sang to them as she eased their fears, their angers, and their many pains. Their agony was so great she would have wept if she could. As she corralled her unruly offspring, some of the graspers and the two forms shot at her sendings with lasers, missiles, and solid projectiles. That would have incurred the wrath of the Maw, but not of her. The attacks bothered her little, for she knew the graspers and the two forms did not understand. She had no fear of them. Their weapons could not harm what she had become. Many of the beings' ships followed as she drew in the leavings of her flesh. They formed a grid in front of her, at what they must have thought was a safe distance. It was not, but she kept that knowledge to herself. Hundreds of signals emanated from the ships, aimed toward her. The electromagnetic beams were dazzling cones of prismatic energy flashing in her vision, and the sounds and information they carried were like the buzzing of so many mosquitoes. The display was distracting, and it made thinking harder than it already was. Annoyed, she spoke a single word, using means that every species would understand. Wait. After that, the signal ceased, leaving her in blessed silence. Satisfied, Kira again turned her focus inward. There was much she still didn't understand. Much that she still needed to make sense of. 4. Piece by piece, she worked to assemble a coherent picture of recent events. Again she lived the visit to Bug Hunt, again the escape from Orsted Station, and then the long trip to Cordova and the battle that followed. The Cassaba howitzer had exploded. That much she felt sure of. And somehow, the seed had salvaged something of her consciousness, and that of Kar and Kwan, from amid the nuclear inferno. She was Kira Nevarez, but she was also so much more. She was part Kar, part Kwan, and also part the seed. For a lock seemed to have opened in her mind, and she realized there was a storehouse of knowledge she now had access to. Knowledge from the seed, knowledge from the time of the vanished. Only that wasn't what they had called themselves. Rather, they thought of themselves as the old ones, those who had come before. In the process of saving her, she and the Xeno had finally become fully integrated. But there was more to it, and this too she now understood. There were layers to the seed's abilities, and most of them remained walled off, inaccessible until the Xeno reached a certain size, which she had now far exceeded. So she, who had once been just Kira, and was now far more, far greater, hung there in the blackness of space. And she thought, and studied, and contemplated the branching possibilities that lay before her. The path had grown tangled as a thicket, but she knew that the seed's guiding principle would help guide her, for it was her own principle as well. Life was sacred. Every part of their moral code rested upon that fundamental principle. Life was sacred, and it was her duty to protect it and, where reasonable, disseminate it. While she pondered, she noticed how the ships in the system arrayed themselves, human on one axis, Renawi on another, and as much as they kept their weapons aimed at her, they kept an equal amount aimed at each other, two fleets facing off with her in the middle. The ceasefire was an uneasy one. Even with the death of the great and mighty Catane, it would take little to reignite the flames of war. The two species had had nothing but the Maw to bind them together, and both were, at heart, ruthless, bloodthirsty, and expansionist. That much she knew from her life as Kira, and also from her life as Shoal Leader Namarl. Then, too, she felt responsible for the war. Her that was Karin Kwan. Her that had been the Maw and its offspring. Her that now floated in orbit around the Cordovan star. And she knew that more of her unfortunate offspring moved among the stars, spreading terror, pain, and death among the humans and Renawi. And her that was Kira felt fear for her family. Nor was that all. She remembered the planet the Maw had infested, an entire sphere of living things, transformed into service of the misguided flesh. Machines there were, too, and ships also, and all sorts of dangerous devices. The thought distressed her. She wanted peace in all its forms. She wanted to give the gift of life, that both humans and Renawi might stand together and breathe air that smelled of green and good and not metal and misery. She knew then what she needed to do. Watch and do not interfere, she said to the waiting fleets. First, the most painful part. She drew upon what had been the hidden knowledge of the seed and transmitted a powerful signal from the system. Not a cry, not a plea, but a command. A killing command, directed at the makings of the maw. Upon reception, it would unknit the cells of the corrupted, disassemble their bodies, and reduce them to the organic compounds that comprise them. What the seed had made, it could unmake. A cleansing was necessary, and she could think of no faster way to stop the violence and suffering. The task had fallen to her, and she would not shy from the work, however sorrowful. With that done, she formed agents of her flesh and sent them forth to the damaged ships that floated abandoned around the planet the Renawi had been mining. Other parts of herself she dispatched to the bands of asteroids, with the goal of extracting the materials she needed. While the drones pursued their function, she set to work upon the main body of her flesh, restructuring it to fit her intention. Around her core, she formed an armored sphere that served to protect what remained of her original body. From that, she extruded polished black panels designed to absorb every ray of sunlight that struck them. Power. She needed power if she were to accomplish her goal. The seed had plenty of its own, but not enough for what she had in mind. What mind? No mind. She laughed to herself, a quiet song in space. Drawing upon the seed's banks of encoded knowledge, she began to build the needed machines, constructing them from the atomic level up. With energy gathered from the panels, she sparked a burning sun inside herself, a fusion reactor large enough to drive the biggest UMC battleship. With energy from the artificial star, she started to manufacture antimatter, far more than the inefficient techniques of the humans or the Renawi allowed for. The old ones had mastered the means of antimatter production before either species had even come into being. And with antimatter as fuel, she built a modified torque engine that allowed her to twist the fabric of the universe and siphon energy directly from FTL space, which was, as she had come to understand, how the seed powered itself. As her agents took possession of the damaged ships, they sometimes found wounded humans or Renawi forgotten upon the vessels. The wounded often attacked, but she ignored their attacks and tended to their injuries, despite any protestations, before sending the abandoned crew off to their kind in escape pods taken from the ships or that she had made herself. When the drones returned with ships and stones in tow, Kira devoured the materials they contained, much as the maw would have, and added them to the structures taking shape around her. The watching fleets grew nervous at this, and several of the vessels flashed her with powerful signals in an attempt to talk with her. Wait, she said, and they did. Although both humans and Renawi retreated even farther, leaving a wide berth of space around her. With energy and mass to spare, Kira put all her efforts into construction. The endeavor was not purely mechanical. Along with beams and braces and metal girders, she allowed the seed to create special chambers that it filled with an organic soup, heated bioreactors that began to produce the living materials needed for the finished product. Woods stronger than any steel. Seeds and buds and eggs and more besides. Vines that crawled and clung and could transmit electricity as efficiently as copper cable. Fungal superconductors. And a whole ecosystem of flora and fauna drawn from the seed's vast experience, and which it and Kira believed would work in a harmonious whole. She moved quickly, but her efforts took time. Days passed, and still the fleet sat waiting and watching. And still she built. From her central core grew four enormous struts that extended forward, backward, left, and right, so that they made a cross with arms of equal length. She extended the cross meter after meter until each strut was 3.5 kilometers long and thick enough to fly a cruiser through. Then she set the seed to joining the tips of the cross with a great equatorial ring, and from the end of each strut, a rib began to grow both up and down and curving inward, as if hugging the surface of an invisible orb. The seed was so large by then that Kira could hardly imagine being confined to a body the size of a human or a Renawi. Her consciousness encompassed the whole of the structure, and she was aware of every part of it at every moment. It was, she imagined, much how a ship mind must feel. The substance of herself expanded to match the demands of the sensory input, and with that expansion came a breadth of thought she had never before experienced. Construction was yet ongoing, but she was no longer willing to wait. Time had grown short indeed. Besides, all who watched could see what she had set out to make, a space station greater in size than any that human or Renawi had built. Parts of it were metallic gray, but most of it was green and red, reflecting the organic material that made up the bulk of the station. It was a living thing, as much as any person, and Kira knew it would continue to grow and evolve for decades, if not centuries, to come. But, like all gardens, it needed tending. She put her attention into several chambers close to her core, sealed them from the vacuum, filled them with air hospitable to both humans and Renawi, gave them gravity suitable for either species, and finished them in a style that seemed fitting. To that end, she combined elements of design from the Renawi, the old ones, and the part of her that was Kira, from each choosing what was most to her liking. At her command, a pair of agents brought her the hardened core of what had once been Katane, the great and mighty Katane. The Renawi would not care what happened to it. They were indifferent to bodies. But she did. She took the blackened remnants and again remade the substance of its flesh by converting the leaden pillars into 7 shards of gleaming crystal, blue-white and dazzling to behold. Each crystal she set within a different chamber, there to serve as a warning, a remembrance, and a symbol of renewal. Then finally she broke her silence. Admiral Klein, Shoal Leader Lafette, I wish to speak to you. Come, meet me here. Falcone, you also. And bring Trig with you. Chapter 2. Unity. 1. Kira watched as the 3 spaceships drew near, the UMCS Unrelenting Force, the SLV Wallfish, and a battle-scarred Renawi vessel whose name, when translated, was Swift Currents Beneath Silent Waves. Each of the ships was massively different in appearance. The Unrelenting Force was long and thick, with numerous hard points along its hull for lasers, missile launchers, and railguns. It was painted a dark, matte gray, which stood in stark contrast to the glittering silver-laced diamond of its radiators. The Wallfish was far shorter and smaller, stubby even, its hull a familiar brown, scuffed and pitted by years of impacts from micrometeoroids, and with a large hole where the Renawi had cut into 1 cargo hold. Like the UMC battleship, the Wallfish had the fins of its radiators deployed, many of which had been broken. Last of all, there was the Renawi ship, a polished, shell-white orb marred only by a blaster burn smeared across its prow. The 3 ships used RCS thrusters to slow themselves as they approached the docking ports Kira had grown for them. In the velvet background, swarms of her drones flew past, busy as bees. Her attention was as much with them as with her visitors, but Kira couldn't help but feel a strange tilting sensation in her core. Was that unease? It surprised her. Even with everything she had become, she still wondered what Falcone would think of her. And not just Falcone. When the airlock to the Wallfish opened, the entire crew came trooping out, including Nielsen, still wearing a bandage around her ribs, and the entropist, Vera. They brought with them Trig's cryotube, mounted on a rolling pallet, which pleased Kira to see. The Unrelenting Force disgorged Admiral Klein, and with him an entire troop of UMCN Marines in full power armor. Likewise, a group of armed Renawi accompanied Lafette as the Shoal Leader left its ship. Near scent of concern and curiosity emanated from the graspers. Among them was Atari, and also a single human, Major Cheddar, her expression unreadable as ever. This way, Kira said, and lit a line of emerald lights down the corridor facing them. Both the humans and the Renawi followed her lead. She watched from the walls and the floors and the ceiling, for she was all of those and more. Falcone looked uncertain of himself, but she was glad to see that he seemed whole and healthy, and that his shoulder injury no longer pained him. Klein showed no emotion, but his eyes darted from side to side, watching for anything unexpected. Aside from the Marines, all the humans were wearing skin suits with helmets firmly attached. The Ranawi, as usual, made no concessions to the environment, trusting their current forms to protect them. As the visitors entered the presence chamber she had created to receive them, Kira shifted her view back to the flesh she had formed for herself, that Klein, Lafette, and Falcone would have an image of her to look at. It seemed the polite thing to do. The chamber was high and narrow, with an arched ceiling and a double row of columns grown of nanar, the coral-like excrescence she knew of from Quan and was fond of because. Walls were framed with spars of polished metal, dark gray and adorned with lines of blue that form patterns of meaning known only to the old ones, and now her. Filling the frames were great curving sections of wood and vines and dark-leafed greenery. And those were from her that was Kira. Also the flowers that rested in crannies dark and shadowed, drooping flowers with purple petals and speckled throats, midnight constellations, in memory of her home and of Alan, of all that she had once been. She had repeated the shape of the flowers on the floor, in fractal spirals that coiled without end, and the sight pleased her, gave her a sense of satisfaction. Among the spirals stood one of the crystals she had made of Katane, a frozen flame of faceted beauty, life arrested, yet still reaching and yearning. A few glow lights hung from the branches of Nanar above, ripened fruit pulsing with a soft golden ambience. In the broken beams of light that reached the floor, pollen swirled like smoke, heavy and fragrant. A trickle of running water sounded amid the pitted columns, but otherwise the chamber was still and silent, sacred. Kira made no demands, issued no ultimatums, but Klein spoke a single word to his troops, and the Marines held their position by the arched entryway as the Admiral continued forward. Lafette did the same with its guard, including Atari, and Human and Renawi advanced with Major Cheddar and the crew of the Wallfish in tow. As they neared the far end of the presence chamber, Kira allowed the glow lights to brighten, banishing the shadows before a rising dawn so they might behold her. The visitors stopped. She looked down upon them from where her new body lay embedded within the root-like structure of the wall, green upon green and threaded throughout with the glossy black fibers of the seed, the wondrous, life-giving seed. "Welcome," said Kira, and it felt strange to speak with a mouth and tongue, stranger still to hear the voice that came forth. A voice that was deeper than she remembered, and contained hints and echoes of both Carr and Quan. "Oh, Kira," said Nielsen. "What have you done?" Through her visor, her expression was one of worry. "You okay?" Falcone asked, brows drawn together in his habitual scowl. Admiral Klein cleared his throat. "Ms. Nevarez!" "Welcome," said Kira, and smiled. Or at least she tried. She wasn't sure if she remembered how. "I have asked you here, Admiral Klein, and you, Shoal Leader Lafette, to act as representatives for both humans and jellies."
"Lafette here, I am no longer Shoal Leader Idealis."
And Cheddar translated the Renawi's words for the humans listening. "How then shall I address you, Lafette?" Kira spoke in both English and Nearsent that all might understand.
"Lafette here, as the great and mighty Lafette."
A faint prickle passed along the spines of the station, as a breath of cold wind along Kira's back. "You have taken the place of Katane, now that Katane is dead." It was not a question. The tentacles of the Ranawi flushed red and white and rubbed together in a prideful gesture.
"Lafette here, that is correct, Idealis. Every arm of the Ranawi is now mine to command."
Admiral Klein shifted his weight. He seemed to be growing impatient.
"What is this all about, Nevarez? Why have you brought us here? What are you building and why?"
She laughed slightly, a musical sound similar to the trickle of a mossy creek.
"Why?
For this that I shall tell you. Humans and jellies will fight as long as they have no common ground. The nightmares, the corrupted, provided a shared enemy. But that enemy is now gone."
"Lafette here, are you sure of that, Idealis?"
She understood what Lafette was really asking. Was the Maw truly gone? Was she it, still a threat.
Yes, I can promise you that. The suit I am bonded with, which you know as the Idealis, and you, Admiral Klein, know as the Softblade, shall not cause such problems again. Also, I have sent a command to the corrupted outside this system. When it reaches them, they will cease to be a threat to any living creature.
The Admiral looked doubtful.
How so? Do you mean?
I mean, said Kira, her voice echoing above them, that I have unmade the corrupted. You no longer need worry about them.
You killed them, said Nielsen in a subdued tone. The others seemed pleased and troubled in equal measure.
Kira bent her neck. There was no other choice. But the issue remains. Humans and jellies will never stay allies without reason. Well, I have provided the reason. I have made this common ground.
This? Said Klein, looking around at the chamber. This place?
She smiled again. The expression was easier the second time.
It is a space station, Admiral. Not a ship. Not a weapon. A home. I made it much as the old ones, the Vanished, would have. In their tongue, it would be called Mar Ineth. In ours, it is Unity.
Unity,
said Klein, appearing to chew on the word. Kira nodded as best she could. This is a place for coming together, Admiral. It is a living, breathing thing that will continue to grow and blossom with time. There are rooms fit for humans, and rooms for jellies. Other creatures will live here also, caretakers that will tend to Unity's many parts. Cheddar spoke then, on her own.
You want us to use this station as an embassy, is that it?
More than that, said Kira. As a hub for our two races, there will be enough space for millions to live here, maybe more. All who come will be welcome as long as they keep the peace. If the idea still gives you unease, then think of this. I have built Unity with means and methods that not even the jellies understand. I will allow those who stay here to study the station, and to study me. That alone ought to be incentive enough.
Admiral Klein seemed troubled. He crossed his arms and sucked on the inside of his cheek for a moment.
And what guarantee do we have that this Xeno won't go rogue again and kill everyone on board?
A ripple of purple ran the length of Lafette's tentacles, an offended response.
Lafette here, the Idealis has already given their promise to form. Your concern is unwarranted.
Oh, is it? Said Klein. The millions, if not billions, of people the Nightmares killed say otherwise. Lafette here, you do not—
Kira rustled the leaves along the walls, and the soft susurration stopped the conversation, made everyone freeze and then look back at her.
I can give you no guarantees, Admiral Klein, but you have seen how I have helped and healed the members of your fleet that I have found.
He cocked his head.
That's true.
Sometimes you just have to trust on faith, Admiral. Sometimes you have to take a chance.
It's a hell of a chance, Nevarez.
Cheddar looked over at him.
Not having a relationship with the jellies would be worse.
A sour expression formed on Klein's face.
That doesn't mean that here is the right place to set up diplomatic relations, and there's no way in hell civilians should be allowed anywhere near Cordova. Not until intelligence has a chance to go over it with a fine-tooth comb. Besides, I don't have the authority to negotiate this sort of an agreement. You're gonna have to deal with the League here and not me, and that's gonna take time. My guess is they'll want to send someone out here to talk with you face to face. That means at least another month and a half before any of this can be settled.
She didn't argue, but looked at the Renaui.
Kira here. What say you, great and mighty Lafette?
A blossom of red and orange passed across the nearby Renaui.
Lafette here. The arms would be honored to accept your offer, Idealis. The opportunity to study a making such as this one we have not had in this or any other ripple. Tell us how many Renaui may stay upon this station, and I shall send for them at once.
As Cheddar translated, Klein set his jaw.
Is that so? Fine. The League can sort out the details later, but I'll be damned if I'm letting the jellies get the jump on us. However many personnel they post here, I want clearance to bring over just as many of my own people.
This time Kira knew better than to smile. Of course, Admiral. I do have a condition, though.
His stance stiffened. And what's that, Nevarez?
This goes for everyone who wants to live on or visit Unity.
No weapons allowed. If you bring them on board, I will destroy them and expel you.
Lafette here. Of course, Idealis. We will obey your wishes.
Klein cocked his head. What about, say, repair bots or service lasers? In the right hands, even a fork could be a deadly weapon.
Humans. Use common sense, Admiral. I'll allow power armor as long as it is disarmed. But make no mistake. If anyone starts a fight on this station, human or jelly, I will put an end to it.
And her voice deepened until it echoed from the walls, as if all of Unity were in her throat. In a way, it was.
Even under his spacer's tan, Klein's cheeks grew pale. Point taken. You won't have any trouble from my crews, Nevarez. You have my word.
Lafette here, nor from the forms loyal to the arms.
Kira allowed them to feel her pleasure then, in the color and brightness of the glow lights, in the happy trill of the water, and in the comforting rustle of the leaves.
Then it is settled.
Satisfied, she shifted her attention to Falcone and the crew of the Wallfish, and she looked at each of them in turn. Sparrow scratched at her side through her skin suit.
Shit, Kira. You sure don't do anything halfway, do you?
Sparrow. Then Vishal spoke up.
How did you survive, Miss Kira? We thought for sure the Cassaba Howitzer had killed you.
At that, Admiral Klein appeared even more uncomfortable. It was he who had authorized the detonation, Kira felt sure. But she didn't care. Assigning blame wouldn't do any good at this point, and besides, setting off the Cassaba Howitzer had been the logical choice. The Maw had to be stopped. Bemused, she said, I think perhaps it did. For a time, at least. A grunt came from Hua Chung, and with a quick motion of her hand, the machine boss made the sign of the cross.
Are you... you?
A disjointed memory flashed through Kira's reconstituted brain. A gray holding cell. A mirrored window. Cold grating beneath her knees. A hollow flickering to life in front of her. And Major Cheddar standing before her in a gray uniform. And the Major saying,
Do you still feel like yourself?
A small chuckle escaped Kira. Yes. And no. I'm something more than I was. The machine boss's eyes bored into her, hot as thermal lances.
No. Are you you, Kira? Here.
She tapped her sternum.
Where it matters. Is your soul still the same?
Kira thought. My soul? I don't know how to answer that question, Hua Chung. But what I want now is the same thing I wanted before. That is peace and for life to flourish. Does that mean I'm the same person? Maybe. Maybe not. Change is not always a bad thing. Still, Hua Chung seemed troubled.
No, it is not. And what you say is good, Kira. But do not forget what it means to be human.
Forgetting is very much what I don't want to do, said Kira. At that, the machine boss seemed, if not happy, at least satisfied. Then Kira shifted her gaze to Vera. The Entropist stood with her forearms clasped across her chest, hands tucked into the voluminous sleeves of her gradient robes. The woman had bruised circles under her eyes, and her cheeks were gaunt, as if from a great sickness. My condolences, Questant Vera, for the loss of your partner. We understand. The Entropist pressed her lips together, nodded, and bowed low. Thank you, Prisoner Kira. Your concern is comforting. Kira inclined her head in return. Prisoner no more, Questant. Surprise widened the Entropist's features. What? That isn't... How do you mean? But Kira did not answer. Instead, she looked again at Falcone. Salvo?
Kira,
he replied, somber. You brought Trig?
Of course.
Do you trust us, Salvo? He hesitated, and then nodded.
I wouldn't have brought the kid if I didn't.
That warmed the center of Kira's being. Again, she smiled. It was fast becoming her favorite expression. Then trust me once more. From the fractal floor, she sent a thicket of tendrils, green this time, not black, sprouting up around Trig's cryotube. Sparrow and Hua Chung cursed and jumped away from the tube, while at the back of the chamber, the ranks of armored marines stiffened and lifted their weapons.
Put those down, Klein barked. At ease!
Kira's smile never wavered as the tendrils twined around Trig's tube, encasing it in a twisting, squirming embrace, burying it beneath the mass of greenery.
Kira, said Nielsen in a soft tone, not warning, not angry, but concerned. Trust me, she said. By means of the vines that were her limbs, she reached into the cryotube and ran 1,000 different threads into Trigg's damaged flesh, seeking the source of his injuries. There, a collection of burned cells, torn muscles, bruised and damaged tendons, ruptured blood vessels, and severed nerves. The insults to his body were as easy for her to feel as the internal structure of the station. How could she have ever found this hard? The thought seemed inconceivable. Then she poured the needed energy into Trigg's frozen form, guided the seed as it worked to repair his wounds. When all seemed right, she removed the respirator from his mouth and disconnected the tubes from his arms, separating him from the machine that had kept him in suspended animation for over 1/2 a year. Slowly, carefully, she warmed his body, treating it as gently as a mother hen would a newly laid egg. She felt the heat of his metabolism increase like a kindling fire rising to full flame until, at last, he took his first, unsupported breath. She released him then. The vines retracted into the floor to reveal Trigg's pale form curled in a fetal shape, bare except for a pair of gray thermal shorts of the sort worn under skin suits. He gasped, like a drowning man coming to the surface, and hacked up a gob of spit. It melted away, as if it had never existed. Trigg! Exclaimed Nielsen, and she and Vishal bent over the kid, Sparrow, Huachung, and Falcone crowded in close, watching.
Where am I?
Trigg said. His voice was weak, hoarse.
That is somewhat hard to explain, said Vishal.
Falcone shrugged off his vest and draped it over the kid's shoulders.
Here, this'll help keep you warm.
Huh? Why are you all wearing skin suits? Where am I?
Then Sparrow moved out of the way, and Trigg saw Kira, suspended as she was, in the wall. His mouth dropped open.
That you, Kira?
Welcome back, she said, and her voice blossomed with warmth. We weren't sure you were going to make it. Trigg looked around the pillared chamber, his eyes showed white.
Is all this yours?
It is. The kid tried to get to his feet, but his knees buckled, and he would have fallen if Huachung hadn't caught him by the arm.
Careful,
she rumbled. Trigg shook his head. Then he looked at Falcone with a plaintive expression.
Are we still at Bug Hunt?
No, said Falcone. That we aren't. Let's get you back to the Wallfish and have the doc check you out. Then you can rest up and we'll fill you in on everything you've missed.
It's been exciting, Sparrow said in a dry tone.
Yes, sir. Rest sounds pretty darn nice right now. Feels like I got worked over by a couple guys with hammers.
The kid's words cut off as he saw Lafette and, by the back of the chamber, the rest of the Renaui. He yelped and attempted to scramble backwards, but Huachung grabbed him by the arm again, held him in place.
Jellies! Come on! We gotta—
We know, said Nielsen in a soothing voice. It's okay. Trigg, stop. Look at me. It's okay. Take a breath. Calm down. We're all friends here. The kid hesitated, glancing between them as if uncertain what to believe. Then Sparrow gave him a light punch on the shoulder.
As I said, it's been exciting.
That's one way to put it, muttered Falcone. Nielsen's right, though. We're all friends here.
His gaze darted toward Kira for an instant before returning to the kid. Trigg relaxed then and stopped pulling against Huachung.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir.
Perfectly understandable, said Falcone and patted him on the back.
Then Kira shifted her attention back to her other guests.
Admiral Klein, great and mighty Lafette, you have seen what I can do. If you have any other crew members who are wounded, wounded beyond your ability to heal, bring them here, and I will do for them what I did for Trigg.
Lafette here, your generosity is without equal, Idealis. But those of the Renaui who are hurt beyond repair will transfer to new forms rather than suffer with an injury.
As you wish. A deep furrow appeared between Klein's eyebrows.
That's a damn kind offer, Navarez, but biocontainment protocol doesn't allow for—
Biocontainment protocol, said Kira in a gentle voice, has already been well and truly broken. Wouldn't you agree, Admiral?
His scowl deepened.
You may have a point, but the League would court-martial me if I violated quarantine like that.
You must have run tests on the men and women I already healed.
Of course.
And?
Nothing, growled Klein. Tex can't find a damn thing wrong with them.
So there you go. He shook his head.
No, we don't. The extenuating circumstances couldn't find anything wrong with you either before the Xeno came out of you. So forgive me if I'm somewhat less than blasé about the situation, Nevarez.
She smiled, but this time less out of pleasure than a desire to appear unthreatening. The League holds no sway here, Admiral. Nor shall it. I am claiming this system for myself, for unity, and neither the League nor the Jelly shall dictate laws here. While you are under my protection, you are a free man, Admiral. Free to make whatever choices your conscience dictates.
A free man. He snorted and shook his head. You have some gall, Nevarez.
Maybe. I made my offer not out of consideration for you, Admiral, but for your crews. If you have men or women who are suffering, whom you can't heal, I can help. That is all. The decision is yours. Then she looked past him, at the Renaui near the back of the chamber. Itari, it is good to see you unharmed. I am grateful for the help you provided on the battered Hierophant. A ripple of bright colors passed across the Renaui's tentacles.
Itari here. It pleases this one to have been of use.
Kira returned her gaze to the forefront. Great and mighty Lafet, without Itari's service during recent events, we might never have defeated Catane. As a favor to me, I ask that you grant Itari hatching rights, as well as a choice of whatever form it wishes to have. Near scent of agreement reached her.
Lafette here, your request is reasonable, Idealis. It will be done.
And Itari turned blue and purple.
Itari here. Thank you, Idealis.
Kira responded with pleasant near scent of her own. Then she shifted her attention to the rest of her guests.
I have said what needed saying. Now I must return to my work. Leave me, and I shall send for you when I am ready to talk again.
Admiral Klein gave a sharp nod, turned on his heel, and marched toward the back of the chamber. Lafette paused to make a sign of courtesy with its tentacles, a wriggle and a flash of color that Kira recognized from Quan's memories, and followed suit. Last of all, the crew of the Wallfish departed also, but not before Falcone gave her one more look and said,
Are you going to be okay, Kira?
She gazed down at him with fondness, and the whole chamber seemed to bend toward him. I'm going to be fine, Salvo. Absolutely fine. All is well. And she meant it with her entire being.
All right, then,
he said. But he did not appear convinced. 2. With her visitors departed, Kira returned to the work of building out the station. Lafette's promised Renaui soon arrived, and she guided them to their watery quarters. Directly afterward, Klein sent over a contingent of UMC researchers. Those two she provided housing within the frame of her expanding body, and she offered them fruit grown of Mara-Neth. But while the researchers accepted the fruit, they did not taste of it, and they kept their skin suits on at all times, which she knew was no small discomfort. No matter. It was not her place to force them to trust. The Renaui were less concerned for their safety, and gladly partook of her hospitality, either because of their history with the seed and its kin, or because of their disregard for individual bodies, Kira wasn't sure which. Along with the Renaui came Shudder. When Kira asked the woman why she had not rejoined the UMC, she said,
After all the time I spent with the Jellies, UMCI would never allow me to have my old job back. As far as they're concerned, I've been irrevocably compromised.
So what will you do? Said Kira. The once major gestured at the station around her.
Work as a liaison between humans and Jellies. Try to avoid another war. Lafette has chosen me to serve as a translator and facilitator with the UMC and the League, and Admiral Klein has agreed to the same.
She shrugged.
I think I might be able to do some good here. Ambassador Cheddar. It has a nice ring to it, don't you think?
Kira did, and it heartened her to see the hope Cheddar had in her new work, as well as the woman's optimism for their shared future. Outside the station, ships continued to gather, human, Renaui, and those Kira had built to bring her supplies from throughout Cordova. They clustered around her like bees around a flower full of nectar, and she felt a sense of pride when she looked at them. A signal beam flashed toward her from the Wallfish. Out of curiosity, she answered, and the familiar sound of Grigorovich's voice filled her hidden ears.
Greetings, O Mitzak. Now you are as I am.
How do you like being bounded in this particular nutshell?
I have transcended the nutshell, Shipmind.
Oh, a bold claim that.
It is true, she said. Then, how do you manage to keep track of everything that is yourself? There is so much. His answer was surprisingly sober.
It takes time, O Queen of Thorns. Time and work. Do not make any hasty judgments until you are sure of yourself. After I transitioned, it took 1.5 years before I knew who the new me was.
He giggled, ruining his serious air.
Not that I ever really know who I am. Who does, We change as circumstances change, like wisps blown on the wind.
She thought on that for a time. Thank you, Grigorovich.
Of course, station mind. Whenever you need to talk, call, and I will listen.
Kira took his advice seriously. Even as she labored on unity, she redoubled her efforts to sort through the mess of memories strewn throughout her reconstituted brain, struggling to pin down and identify which ones belonged to which parts of herself, struggling to figure out exactly who she was. She paid particular attention to the memories of the Maw, and it was while studying them that she made a discovery that filled her with cold dread. Oh, no. For she remembered. Before coming to Cordova 1420, the Maw had taken precautions against its possible defeat, unlikely as that seemed. It had, in the darkest depths of interstellar space, formed 7 avatars from its flesh and the flesh of the seed. 7 living, thinking, self-directed copies of itself. And the Maw had sent off its virulent, wrath-filled clones with no knowledge of where they might ultimately go. Kira thought of the killing command she had broadcast before. Surely that would. But then, from the seed, she felt an unshakable conviction that the command would not stop the Maw's avatars, for they were the seed, twisted and broken as the Maw had been, but still of the same underlying substance. Unlike the corrupted, she could not unmake the Maw's poisonous spawn with a single line, just as she could not have unmade the Maw. The seed did not possess such power over itself. The old ones had not seen fit to give their creations that ability, preferring to keep it for themselves in the shape of the Staff of Blue. But the staff was broken, and Kira knew that even if she had the pieces, she could not repair it. The knowledge was not in her, and that too was the old ones' doing. They had, she decided, been overconfident in their supremacy. Her dread deepened as she pondered the situation. The Maw's offspring would spread their evil wherever they went, blanketing planets with corrupted, converting or overriding any existing life. The 7 represented an existential threat to every other being in the galaxy. Their legacy would be one of misery, the exact opposite of everything the seed was supposed to embody. The thought haunted her. With a sense of regret, Kira realized her afterlife was not to be as she'd imagined. The Maw was her responsibility, and so too were the 7 deadly darts it had let loose among the stars. Chapter 3. Decession. 1. Kira acted without hesitation. Time was short, and she had no intention of wasting it. To the ships assembled around her, she said, "Stand clear." A scramble of activity followed as the captains pulled their ships back. Then she ignited thrusters along the ribs of the station and began to move it, slowly and ponderously, toward the planet the Renawi had been mining. The UMC had called it R1, but Kira thought it deserved a proper name. She would leave it to the people living on Unity to name it, though. It was their right as the inhabitants of the system. Both Lafette and Admiral Klein signaled her as the station started to shift its position.
"Nevarez, what are you doing?"
Klein asked.
"Taking up high orbit around R1, she said. "It will be a better location for Unity."
"Roger that, Nevarez. We'll secure your flight path. Next time, some warning would be appreciated."
"Lafette here, do you require any assistance, Idealis?"
"None at the moment." 2. Moving Unity took several days. Kira used that time to make the preparations she needed, and when she had settled the station into its final orbit, she summoned the crew of the Wallfish to her once again. They came without delay. The old ramshackle ship docked near her central hub, and Kira saw that most of the damage the Wallfish had sustained had been repaired,
though several of its radiators were still little more than needle-tipped shards. The crew chattered amongst themselves with nervous excitement as they walked her hallways, but they kept the external speakers to their skin suits turned off, and the movement of their lips was the only obvious giveaway. But she was curious, and she bathed their visors with an invisible wash of collimated light which allowed her to read the vibrations of their voices.
"Idea what she wants?"
said Trigg. He sounded excited. Falcone grunted.
"You've asked that 3 times now."
"Sorry."
The kid sounded slightly abashed. Then Nielsen said,
"Klein was pretty clear about what we're supposed to."
"I don't give 2 shits what the brass thinks,"
said Sparrow.
"This is Kira we're talking about. Not a jelly, not a nightmare, Kira."
"Are you sure about that?"
Falcone asked. A moment of silence followed. Then Sparrow thumped her chest with her fist.
"Yeah, she's got a back. She healed Trigg after all."
"And we're still being quarantined as a result," said Falcone.
Hua-Chung smiled slightly.
"Life is never perfect."
At that, the captain laughed, as did Nielsen. Kira returned her sight and hearing to her remade body as the crew entered her presence chamber. They stopped before her, and she smiled down upon them. A slow fall of petals drifted from above, pink and white and smelling of warm perfume.
"Welcome," she said.
Falcone inclined his head. A wry smile flickered about his mouth.
"Don't know why, but it feels like I should be bowing to you."
"Please don't," she said.
"You shouldn't have to bow to anyone or anything. You're not servants, and you're certainly not slaves."
"Damn right,"
said Sparrow, and gave Kira a small salute. Then Kira looked at Trigg.
"How are you feeling?"
The kid shrugged, trying to appear nonchalant. His cheeks had regained a healthy color.
"Pretty good. I just can't believe all the stuff I missed."
"It's not the worst thing. If I could have slept through the past 6 months, I would have too."
"Yeah, I know. You're probably right, but geez, jumping off the maglev on Orsted, that must have been pretty exciting."
Sparrow snorted.
"You could say that. Damn new suicidal would be the other way."
The kid flashed a quick grin before growing more serious.
"But yeah, thanks again for patching me up, Kira. Really.
I'm just happy I could help," she said, and the chamber seemed to glow in response.
Then she shifted her focus to Vishal. He was standing next to Nielsen, their shoulders nearly touching. "Was there anything with Trigg that I overlooked? Any problems that I might have caused?"
"I feel fine,"
the kid proclaimed, puffing out his chest. The doctor shook his head.
"Trigg appears to be the very picture of health. His blood work and neural responses could not be improved even if I tried."
Falcone nodded.
"Seriously, we owe you, Kira. If there's anything we can do for you."
The leaves interrupted him with a stir of disapproval. "Seeing as how none of this would have happened if not for me," she said.
"Consider us even."
He chuckled. It was good to hear him laugh again.
"Fair enough."
Trigg hopped from foot to foot. He looked as if he were going to burst with excitement.
"Tell her,"
he said, looking at Vishal and Nielsen.
"Come on, or I'll tell her."
"Tell me what?" Kira asked, curious. Nielsen made a face, seeming embarrassed.
"You're not going to believe this," Falcone said.
Then Vishal took Nielsen's hand and stepped forward.
"Miss Kira, I have an announcement to make. Miss Audrey and I have gotten engaged, and she asked me, Miss Kira, me."
Nielsen blushed and laughed softly. "It's true," she said, and she looked at the doctor with a warmth Kira had never seen from her before. Few things could now surprise Kira, not the turning of the stars, not the decay of atomic nuclei, not the seemingly random quantum fluctuations that underlay reality as it appeared, but this surprised her, although, in retrospect, she supposed it wasn't entirely unexpected.
"Congratulations," she said with all the heartfelt emotion she could summon. The happiness of 2 beings might be a small thing when compared with the immensity of the universe, but what, ultimately, was more important?
Suffering was inescapable, but to care for another and be cared for in turn, that was the closest any person might come to heaven.
Vishal bobbed his head. "Thank you, Miss Kira. We won't get married until we can have a proper wedding with my mother and sisters and lots of guests and food with... Well, we'll see," said Nielsen with a small smile.
The doctor returned the smile and put an arm around her shoulders.
"Yes, we do not want to wait too long, do we? We've even talked about someday buying a cargo vessel and starting a shipping company of our own, Miss Kira."
"Whatever we do, we'll do it together," said Nielsen.
and she kissed him on his shaved cheek, and he kissed her back. Falcone went to scratch his chin, and his fingers bumped against his visor.
"To hell with it,"
he growled, and unlocked and pulled off the helmet.
"Captain,"
said Hua Cheng, sounding scandalized. He waved his hand.
"It's fine."
Then he scratched his chin, and the sound of his nails rasping against his stubble carried throughout the presence chamber.
"As you can tell, we're all in a bit of shock, but they, seem pretty happy, so we're happy."
"Yeah,"
said Trigg, sounding glum. He glanced toward the first officer and released a small sigh. Falcone sniffed the air.
"Smells nice," he said.
Kira smiled, sweeter than before. "I try."
"Okay,"
said Sparrow, rolling her shoulders as if she were about to lift a heavy weight.
"Why'd you call us here, Kira? Just a chit-chat? Doesn't seem like you. Say sorry."
"Yes, I'm rather curious about that myself," said Falcone.
He rubbed a finger against one of the trunk-like pillars and then held it up before his face to examine the residue. Kira took a deep breath. She didn't need to, but doing so helped center her thoughts. "I asked you to come for two reasons. First, to tell you a truth about the Maw."
"Go on,"
said Falcone, wary. So she did. She told them the secret of the 7 evil seeds that she had discovered amid the Maw's memories. As she spoke, she watched as their faces grew pale and their expressions stricken.
"Gods!" Nielsen exclaimed.
"You're saying there are 7 more of those things wandering around Thul knows where?"
said Sparrow. Even she seemed daunted by the prospect. Kira closed her eyes for a moment. "Exactly. And the Seeker is still out there also, and I can guarantee it's up to no good. Neither the League nor the Jellies can deal with these sorts of threats. They're just not capable of it. I'm the only one, the Seeds, the only one who can stop them."
"So what are you gonna do about it?"
Falcone said, deadly quiet. "What I have to, of course. I'm going to hunt them down." For a time, the only sound in the chamber was the soft fall of petals.
"How?"
said Sparrow.
"They could be anywhere."
"Not anywhere. And as for how, I'd rather not say yet."
"Okay,"
said Falcone, drawing out the word. "What was the other reason you asked us here, then?" "For the giving of gifts." And Kira lowered herself from the wall and released herself from the mesh of root-like fibers that had kept her wrapped in a tight embrace. Her feet touched the floor, and for the first time since the battered Hierophant, Kira stood whole and unassisted. Her body was the same green-black material as the walls of the station, and her hair rippled as if in a breeze, but there was no breeze.
"Whoa,"
said Trigg. Falcone stepped forward, his ice-blue eyes searching her.
"Is this really you?"
"It's as much me as anything else in Unity."
"That works,"
he said, and he caught her in a tight hug, and Kira felt his embrace even on the far struts of the station. The rest of the crew crowded around, touching, hugging, slapping her, lightly, on the back.
"So where's your brain?" asked Trigg, his eyes wide with wonder. "Is it in your head or is it up there?"
He pointed at the wall she'd descended from.
"Trigg," said Hua Cheng. "Aish, show more respect."
"That's okay," said Kira. She touched her temple. "Some is here, but most of it is back there. It wouldn't fit in a normal skull."
"Not so different from a ship mind,"
said Hua Cheng. Kira bowed her head. "Not so different."
"Either way, it's good to see you in one piece,"
said Sparrow.
"Hear, hear," said Nielsen.
"Even if you do look like boiled spinach,"
Sparrow added with a laugh. Then Kira took a step back to give herself space. "Listen," she said. And they listened. "I won't be able to help you much from now on, so I want to do what I can while I can."
"You don't have to," said Falcone.
She smiled at him. "If I had to, they wouldn't be gifts. Trigg, I know you have always been interested in aliens. This, then, is for you." And from the floor by her feet, a rod of green wood sprouted, and it grew in height until it formed a staff nearly as tall as Trigg himself. Near the top, embedded within the braided branches, sat what appeared to be an emerald the size of a robin's egg, and it glowed with an inner light. Kira grasped the staff, and it came off the floor into her hand. Small leaves grew from it in places, and the smell of fresh sap suffused the air. "Here,"
she said, and handed the length of wood to Trig. This is not a staff of blue, but a staff of green. It isn't a weapon, although you may fight with it if you must. There's a part of the seed in it, and if you care for the staff and treat it well, you will find that you can grow most anything, no matter how barren the soil. You will be able to talk with the jellies, and wherever you plant the staff, life will flourish. The staff can do other things also, and if you prove yourself a worthy caretaker, you may discover them as well. Do not allow the UMC to get their hands on it. Awe and wonder shone forth from Trig's face.
Thank you, he said. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't even know. Ah, geez, thank you.
One more thing, Kira said, and she caressed the top of the staff. Once a day, the staff will put forth a fruit, a single red fruit. It's not much, but it is enough to keep you from ever starving. You will never need worry about food again, Trig. At that, tears filled Trig's eyes, and he clutched the staff close to himself.
I won't forget this,
he mumbled. Kira expected he wouldn't. She moved on. Hua Chung. From within her side, Kira took two orbs, one white, one brown. Each was just large enough to rest comfortably in the curve of her palm. She gave the brown one to the machine boss. This is a piece of tech from the old ones. You can use it to repair most any machine. The machine boss sucked on her lower lip as she stared at the orb she now held.
Aish, will it eat the whole of my ship?
Kira laughed and shook her head. No, it's not like the seed. It won't spread uncontrollably. But be careful where you use it, as it may sometimes try to make improvements. Hua Chung disappeared the orb into one of the pouches around her waist, and she mumbled her thanks. Red spots appeared on her cheeks, and Kira could tell how much the gift meant to the machine boss. Pleased, Kira then handed the white orb to the doctor. Vishal, this is also a piece of tech from the old ones. You can use it to repair most any wound. But be careful where you use it, as it may sometimes make improvements, said Vishal with a gentle smile.
Yes, I understand.
She returned his smile. Good. It could have saved Trig back at Bug Hunt. Hopefully you won't ever need it, but if you do...
If I do, better to have it than not.
Vishal placed his hands together, cupping the orb between them and bowed.
Thank you, Miss Kira, most sincerely.
Sparrow was next. Reaching down, Kira removed a short, all-black dagger from the side of her thigh and handed it to the shorter woman. The blade of the knife contained a faint fibrous pattern, similar to the seed. This is a weapon.
No shit.
Metal detectors can't see it. X-rays and microwaves won't pick it up. But that's not what makes it special. But that's not what makes this special. This knife can cut through anything. Sparrow gave her a skeptical look.
Really?
Really, Kira insisted. It may take time, but you can cut through even the toughest materials. And no, you don't have to worry about losing control of it the way I did with the seed. Sparrow eyed the dagger with renewed interest. She flipped it around the back of her hand, caught the handle, and then tested the edge on the corner of one of her utility pouches. As promised, the blade sliced clean through the material, and when it did, a slight glimmer of blue ran the length of the edge.
Handy. Thanks. Something like this would have gotten me out of a couple jams in the past.
For Nielsen, Kira had no easy fixes. She said, Audrey, I could solve your condition. The seed has the ability to reshape any tissue, to recode any gene. But if I did, you would have to change most of my brain, said Nielsen. She smiled sadly. I know. It might not alter your personality or your memories, but I can't promise it wouldn't. Even though the seed has no desire to harm you, quite the opposite. The first officer took a shuddery breath and then lifted her chin, shook her head.
No. I appreciate the offer, Kira, but no. It's a risk I'd rather avoid. Figuring out who I am wasn't easy, and I'm rather fond of who I've become. Losing that wouldn't be worth it. I'm sorry. I wish I could do more.
It's okay, said Nielsen. Plenty of people have to deal with a lot worse. I'll be fine. Vishal hugged her.
Besides, Miss Kira, I will do my best to help Miss Audrey. Genetic modifications were always a specialty of mine in school, ah yes? And Nielsen's expression softened, and she hugged him back.
I'm glad to hear that, said Kira. Even if I can't heal you, there is something I can give you. Several somethings, actually, now that you're engaged.
Nielsen started to protest, but Kira paid her no mind. She knelt and traced two equal circles upon the floor, both no more than 4 or 5 centimeters across. Where she touched, gold lines formed, and they glowed brighter and brighter until they were painful to behold. Then the light broke and faded. In its place lay two rings, gold, green, and laced with sparkles of sapphires. Kira took them and presented them to Nielsen. For you and Vishal, an early wedding present. You're under no obligation to use these, but if you do, you will find that they have certain advantages.
They're beautiful, said Nielsen, accepting the rings. Thank you, but I'm afraid they're both too large for me.
Kira allowed herself a secret amusement. Try and see. So Nielsen slipped on one of the two rings, and she let out a cry as the band tightened around her finger until it formed a snug but comfortable fit.
That is so cool, said Trig.
Kira beamed.
Isn't it?
Then she went to the nearest pillar, and from an alcove in the side removed a pair of objects. She held out the first one to Nielsen. It was a palm-sized disc of what looked like a rough white shell. Embedded within the surface of the shell was a cluster of blue beads, each no bigger than a pea. This is what I originally intended to give you.
What is it?
Nielsen asked, accepting the disc. Relief. The next time your affliction strikes, take one of these. She tapped a bead, and eat it. Just one, no more. They cannot heal you, but they can help you function, make things easier, more bearable.
Thank you, said Nielsen, sounding somewhat overwhelmed.
Kira inclined her head. Given enough time, the beads will regrow, so you will never run out, no matter how long you live. Tears filled Nielsen's eyes.
Seriously, Kira, thank you.
Behind her, Vishal said, You are too kind, Miss Kira. Too kind. But thank you from the deepest part of my heart. Then Kira held out the other object, an ordinary cue drive. Also, there's this. The first officer shook her head.
You've already done more than enough, Kira. I can't accept anything else.
It's not a gift, said Kira gently. It's a request. If you agree, I would like to name you as my legal representative. To that end, there is a document on this drive granting you power of attorney on my behalf.
Kira.
She took Nielsen by the shoulders, looked her in the eyes. I worked for the Lapsang Corporation for over 7 years, and the work paid well. Alan and I plan to use the money to start a new life on Andrastea, but it's not doing me any good now. My request is this. See that the money gets to my family on Wayland, if they're still alive. If they're not, then the bits are yours. Nielsen opened her mouth, seemingly at a loss for words. Then she nodded, brisk, and said,
Of course, Kira. I'll do my best.
Heartened, Kira continued. The company might give you some trouble, so I had Admiral Klein witness and notarize this. That should keep the lawyers off your back. She pressed the cue drive into Nielsen's hand, and the first officer accepted. Then Nielsen wrapped her in a fierce hug.
You have my word, Kira. I'll do everything I can to get this to your family.
Thank you. Once Nielsen released her, Kira walked over to where Falcone stood alone. He cocked an eyebrow at her and then crossed his arms as if suspicious.
And what are you going to give me, Kira? Tickets to a resort on Eidolon? Magic pixie dust that I can sprinkle over the wallfish?
Better, she said. She raised a hand, and from an arched doorway in the side of the chamber, 4 of the station's caretakers trundled forward, pushing a pallet upon which sat a sealed case painted military gray and stamped with UMC markings.
What are those?
Said Trig, pointing with the staff of green at the caretakers. The creatures were small and bipedal, with double-jointed hind legs and short T-Rex arms at the front. Their fingers were delicate and pale to the point of translucence. A flexible tail extended behind them. Polished, tortoise-like plates armored their skin, but they had a feathered frill red and purple along the central ridge of their narrow heads. 4 dragonfly wings lay flat against their backs.
They tend to the station, said Kira.
You might even say they were born from the station.
You mean born from you, said Falcone.
In one sense, yes. The caretakers left the pallet next to them and then retreated,
chittering to themselves as they went. Kira opened the top of the case to reveal rows upon rows of antimatter canisters, each of them with the green light on the side that indicated they were full and powered. Nielsen gasped, and Hua Chung said,
"Dool!"
To Falcone, Kira said, "For you and the wallfish. Antimatter. Some of it I recovered from the vessels I disassembled. The rest I manufactured and transferred into the containment pods." With a stunned expression, Falcone looked over the case.
"There must be enough in here to
power the wallfish for years," said Kira. "Yes. Or you can sell it and stash the bits for a rainy day. It's your choice."
"Thank you.
I'm not done yet," said Kira. She raised her hand again, and the caretakers returned, pushing another pallet. On this one rested pots full of dark earth, from which sprouted a strange and wild array of plants that bore no resemblance to those of Earth, Eidolon, or Wayland. Some glowed, some moved, and one of them, a red stone-like plant, hummed.
"Since you had to strip your hydroponics bay, I thought you could use some replacements," said Kira.
Falcone shook his head.
"That's very thoughtful of you, but how are we supposed to take them anywhere? We don't have enough cryopods and—"
"The pots will protect them during FTL," said Kira. "Trust me." Then she handed him another cue drive. "Information on how to care for the plants, as well as details on each one. I think you'll find them useful." For the first time, she saw tears glimmer in Falcone's eyes. He reached out toward one of the plants, a mottled pitcher-like organism with small tentacles waving about its open mouth, and then thought better of it and pulled his hand back.
"I don't know how to thank you."
"Two more things," she said. "One, this." And she gave him a small metal rectangle, similar in size to a deck of playing cards, for Vera and the entropists to study. Falcone turned the rectangle over. It appeared featureless.
"What is it?"
"Something to point them in the right direction if they can make sense of it," she smiled. "They will eventually. And two, this." And she placed her hands on either side of his face and kissed him on the lips, soft, delicate, and with feeling.
"Thank you, Salvo,"
she whispered.
"For what?"
"For believing in me. For trusting me. For treating me like a person and not a science experiment." She kissed him once more, and then stepped back and raised her arms to either side. Vines unfurled from the wall behind, wrapped themselves around her in a gentle embrace, and then lifted her back up to the waiting depression.
"My gifts are given," she said as she again melded into the substance of the station.
With it came a sense of safety. "Go now, and know this. No matter where time or fate may take us, I consider you my friends."
"What are you gonna do, Kira?"
Falcone asked, craning his neck back to look at her.
"You'll see."
3. As the crew filed out through the entrance and back through the corridors toward the docking area, Kira reached out to Grigorovich, whom she knew would have been listening to the conversation via their comms. "I have something for you as well," she said, "if you want it."
"Oh, really? And what might that be, O ring-giver?"
"A body. A new body. As large or small as you want, metal or organic, in any shape or design that strikes your fancy. Just tell me, and the seed can make it." To Kira's astonishment, the ship mind did not immediately answer. Rather, he was silent. And she could hear his silence as a physical thing, a pressure of contemplation and uncertainty on the other end of the signal. "Think of it. You could go anywhere you wanted to, Grigorovich. You wouldn't need to be bound to the wallfish anymore." At long last, the shipmind said,
"No, but I think perhaps I want to be. Your offer is tempting, Kira, mighty tempting, and don't think I'm ungrateful. But for the time being, I think my place is here, with Falcone and Nielsen and Trigg and Hua Chung and Sparrow. They need me, and I won't lie, it's nice to have meat bags like them running around my decks. You might understand that now. A body would be nice, but I could always have a body. I couldn't always have this crew or these friends."
Kira did understand, and she appreciated his answer. If you change your mind, the offer stands.
I'm glad to have known you, O Queen of Flowers. You are a prickly and problematic person, but life is more interesting with you around. I could not have chosen as you have to pursue these miscreants of the Maw all on your lonesome. For that you have my admiration. Moreover, you showed me the path to freedom. You saved me from myself, and thus you also have my eternal gratitude. If you find yourself in the far distant future, remember us as we remember you. And if the tides of time are kind, and if I still sound of thought, know this, you shall always be able to count upon my aid.
To which she simply replied, Thank you. 4. With her visitors departed and her mind far more at rest, Kira started upon the next stage of her plan. In concept, it was simple. In execution, it was more complicated and dangerous than anything she had attempted since waking in the aftermath of the Maw's destruction. First, she moved herself near the skin of the station. There, she gathered material, organic and inorganic, until she had formed a second core, equal to the one at the center of Unity. Then, and this was the most difficult part, she separated her brain into two unequal parts. Everything that was of Quan and Kar, she isolated and placed in the heart of Unity. Everything that was of Kira, the Seed, and the Maw, she drew to herself. Some duplication was necessary. She could still remember Kar's medical tests and Quan's time spent hunting in the waters of its homeworld, and some omissions and oversights were inevitable. But she did her best. The process was frightening. With every move, Kira worried that she would sever some crucial part of herself, or that she would cut off access to a memory she didn't even know she needed, or that she would kill herself. But again, she did her best. As she had learned, sometimes you had to make a choice, any choice, even when it wasn't clear which path was the right one. Life rarely provided such a luxury. She labored for a night and a day, until everything that seemed to be her fit inside the skull she had chosen, the tiny, limited skull. She felt diminished, but at the same time it was a relief to be free of all the sensory input pouring in from the station. She checked on the Quan Kar consciousness one last time, a mother checking on a sleeping child, and then she separated herself from Mar Ineth and set forth toward the near asteroid belt, using her newly built fusion core to drive her through space. As always, Klein and Lafette came clamoring for answers, so Kira told them of the Maw's 7 deadly seeds, and she explained her intentions. I'm leaving to hunt them down, she said. Klein sputtered.
But what about the station? Lafette here. Yes, Idealis, I share the Shoal leader's concern. The station is too important for it to be unguarded.
Kira laughed.
It's not. I left Kar Quan in charge. What? Said Klein. Lafette here. What?
The part of me that was them now watches over Unity. They will care for it, and if it comes to that, protect it. I suggest you don't anger them.
Lafette here, are you trying to create another corrupted Idealis?
I hate to say it, but I agree with the jelly, said Klein.
Are you trying to give us another Maw?
Kira's voice hardened. The Maw is no more. I have removed all parts of the seed from Kar Quan. What they are now is something different. Something unformed and unsure, but I can tell you this. None of the anger and pain that drove the Maw still exists. Or if it does, it's inside me, not them. You have a new life form to usher into existence, Admiral Klein, Lafette. Treat them accordingly and you'll be pleasantly surprised. Do not disappoint me. 5. When she reached the asteroid belt, Kira slowed herself to a stop near one of the largest asteroids, a huge chunk of metallic rock kilometers across and pitted from countless collisions over the years. There she parked herself, and there again she began to build. This time, Kira drew upon an existing blueprint, one she had found buried deep within the seed's memory banks. It was technology of the old ones, devised at the height of their civilization, and it suited her purpose perfectly. Using the seed, Kira devoured the asteroid, adapting it to her needs, and using the old one's schematic, she built a ship. It was not square and spindly and lined with radiators like the human ships, nor was it round and white and iridescent like the Renawi ships. It was not like any of those things. No, Kira's ship was shaped like an arrow, long and sharp, with flowing lines reminiscent of a leaf. It had veins and ridges and, along its flared stern, fanned membranes. As with Unity, the ship was a living thing. The hull expanded and contracted in subtle motions, and there was a sense of awareness about the vessel, as if it was watching everything around it. In a way, it was, for the ship was an extension of Kira's body. It acted as her eyes, and through it, she could see far more than would otherwise have been possible. When she was finished, Kira had a ship that was over half the size of a UMC battleship and far more heavily armed. Powering it was another torque engine, and with it, Kira felt confident she could exceed the highest speed of any of the Maw's foul offspring. Then she took one last look at the system, at the Cordovan star, at the planet R1 and the verdant framework of Unity floating in orbit high above, at the fleets of human and Renawi ships clustered thereabout, which were, if not entirely friendly, at least no longer shooting. And Kira smiled, for it was good. In her mind, she made her peace, said her last farewells, a silent lament for all that was lost and gone. And then she turned her ship away from the star, pointed it toward the Maw's final memory, and with the smallest of thoughts, started on her way. Exeunt 6. 1. Kira wasn't alone, not yet. As she moved across the face of the void, 4 UMC battleships and 3 Renawi cruisers trailed behind in close formation. Most of the vessels were damaged in some way, explosion scarred and suit besmirched, and, in the case of the human ships, held together more with FTL tape, emergency welds, and the prayers of their crews than anything else. Still, the vessels were space-worthy enough to accompany her. Admiral Klein and Lafitte seemed determined to provide her with an escort all the way to the Markov limit. Not so much for protection, she suspected, as for observation. Also, perhaps, to give her company. Which she appreciated. If anything was going to do her in, it was the silence and the isolation. Once she reached the Markov limit, which for her ship was far closer to the star than for the humans or Renawi, she would leave her escorts behind. They didn't have the means to keep pace with her in superluminal space. And then she would be truly alone. It was something she'd expected from the moment she'd made her decision. Yet Kira found the actuality somewhat daunting. With Kar and Quan removed from her consciousness, her mind was a far emptier place. She was an individual again, not a plurality. And while the seed was a companion of sorts, it was no substitute for normal human interaction. She had always been comfortable working alone, but even on the loneliest outpost the Lapsang Corp sent her to, there had been people to talk and drink with, people to fight and fuck and generally bounce off, mentally and physically. On the long journey that lay before her, there would be none of that. The prospect did not frighten her, but it did concern her. Though she felt secure in herself for now, would extended periods of isolation unbalance her the way it had Grigorovich when he'd been shipwrecked? And might that lead to her becoming more like the Maw? A ripple passed through the surface of the seed, and she shivered, though she was neither cold nor hot. Inside her darkened cradle, she opened her eyes, her real eyes, and stared at the curved surface above her, a map of textured flesh, part plant, part animal. She traced the shapes with her fingertips, feeling their courses, reading their paths. After a time, she again closed her eyes and sent a signal to the wallfish, asked to speak with Falcone. He replied as quickly as the light lag allowed. Hey, Kira, what's up? Then she confessed to him her concern, and she said, I do not know what I may become, given enough time and space. None of us do. I'll say this, though. You're not going to go insane, Kira. You're too strong for that. And you're not going to lose yourself to the seed. Hell, even the Maw couldn't destroy you. This is a cakewalk in comparison. In the darkness, she smiled. You're right. Thank you, Salvo.
Do you need someone to go with you? I'm sure the UMC and the Jellies would have no shortage of volunteers who would love to jet around the galaxy with you.
She seriously considered the idea, and then shook her head, though Falcone couldn't see. No. This is something I have to do myself. If anyone else were here, I'd be worried about protecting them.
Your call. If you change your mind, just let us know.
I will. My one regret is that I won't be around to watch how things turn out between us and the Jellies.
It's good to hear you use the word us. Klein wasn't sure if you still thought of yourself as human.
Part of me does. He grunted.
I know you're going to be out past the rim, but you can still send messages back, and we can figure out a way to do the same. It might take a while, but we can do it. Staying in touch is important.
I'll try. But Kira knew it was unlikely she would hear anything from the League or the Renawi. Even if they knew where she was, by the time their signals reached her, odds were she would have moved on. Only if the Maw's avatars led her back to settled space would it be possible, and she very much hoped that wouldn't be the case. Still, it meant something to her that Falcone cared, and she felt a measure of peace. Whatever the future held, she was ready to face it. When they finished talking, she hailed the unrelenting force. At her request, Admiral Klein agreed to forward a message of hers, minus any information the UMC deemed classified, back to Wayland and her family. It would have been easy enough for Kira to broadcast a signal strong enough to reach Wayland, but she did not know how to structure the waves of energy so they could be received and interpreted by the listening antennas in her home system. Kira wished she could wait for a reply. However, even under the best of circumstances, it would take over 3 months to hear back, assuming her family could be found, and that they were still alive. It pained Kira to realize that she might never know the truth. As she hurtled toward the Markov limit, Kira listened to music sent to her from the Wallfish. Some Bach, but also long, slow orchestral pieces that seemed to match the turn of the planets and the shift of the stars. The music provided a structure to otherwise formless time, a narrative to the impersonal progression of nature's grandest bodies. She dozed inside her living casement, slipping in and out of wakefulness. A true sleep was near at hand, but she put it off, not ready to surrender awareness. Not yet. Not until space distorted around her and cut her off from the rest of the universe. 2. When she arrived at the Markov limit, Kira felt a sense of readiness within the ship. The fabric of reality seemed to grow thinner, more malleable around her, and she knew the time to leave was upon her. She allowed herself a final look around the system. Regret, anxiety, and excitement all stirred within her. But her purpose was just, and it stiffened her resolve. Hers was to go forth into the unknown, to root out the evil seeds and to spread new life throughout the galaxy. It was a good purpose to have. Then she diverted power into the torque engine, preparing for the transition to FTL, and a deep hum pervaded the flesh of the ship. Just as the hum peaked, a crackly transmission reached her. It was from the Wallfish, from Falcone. He said,
Kira, the UMC says you're about to jump to FTL. I know it feels like you're going to be all alone from now on, but you aren't. We're all thinking about you. Don't forget that, you hear me? That's a direct order from your captain. Go kick some nightmare ass, and I expect to see you alive and healthy when...
The hum ceased, and the stars twisted, and a dark mirror enveloped her, isolating her in a sphere no larger than her ship. Then all was silent. Despite herself, Kira felt sad, and she allowed herself to feel that sadness, to acknowledge her loss, and give the emotion the respect it deserved. Part of her resisted. Part of her still made excuses. If she could find the Maw's emissaries and eradicate them within a reasonable amount of time, maybe she could still return home, have a life of peace. She took a breath. No. What was done was done. There was no going back. No point regretting the choices she had made, nor, as Falcone had said, what was out of her control. It was time. She closed her eyes, and although the prospect still unsettled her, she at last allowed herself to sleep, and in that sleep, there were no dreams. 3. An emerald ship sailed through the darkness,
a tiny gleaming dot lost within the immensity of space. No other vessel accompanied it, no guards or companions or watchful machines. It was alone among the firmament, and all was quiet. The ship sailed, but it seemed not to move. A butterfly, bright and delicate, frozen in crystal, preserved like that for all eternity, deathless and unchanging. Once it had flown faster than light. Once and many times besides. Now it did not. The scent it followed was too delicate to track otherwise. The galaxy turned upon its axis for time without measure. Then a flash. Another ship appeared ahead of the first. The newcomer was dented and dirty, with a patched hull and an awkward appearance. On its nose, faded letters spelled a single word. The two ships passed each other in a tiny fraction of a second, their relative velocities so immense there was only time for a brief transmission to pass from one to the other. The transmission was of a man's voice, and it said, "Your family is alive." Then the newcomer was gone, vanished into the distance. Within the lonely ship, within the emerald cocoon and the swaddling flesh, there lay a woman, and though her eyes were closed, and her skin was blue, and though her blood was ice and her heart was still, though all of that, a smile appeared on her face. And so she sailed on, content to hold and wait, and there to sleep in a sea of stars. Addendum. Appendix 1. Spacetime in FTL. Excerpt from the Entropic Principia, revised. Necessary to outline a brief overview of the fundamentals, let this serve as a primer and quick reference guide for later, more serious studies. FTL travel is the defining technology of our modern era. Without it, expansion beyond the solar system would be impossible, barring centuries-long trips on generational ships or automated seed ships that would grow colonists in situ upon arrival. Even the most powerful fusion drives lack the delta V to jet between the stars as we do now. Although long theorized, superluminal travel did not become a practical reality until Ilya Markov codified the Unified Field Theory, UFT, in 2107. Empirical confirmation followed soon afterward, and the first working prototype of an FTL drive was constructed in 2114. Markov's brilliance was in recognizing the fluidic nature of spacetime and demonstrating the existence of the different luminal realms as outlined in the earlier purely theoretical work of Froning, Mihalik, and Gautier around the turn of the 21st century. Prior to that, thinking was constrained by the limitations of general relativity. Per Einstein's formulations for special relativity, coupled with Lorentz transformations, no particle with real mass can accelerate to the speed of light. Not only would that require an infinite amount of energy, doing so would break causality. And as later practical demonstrations have shown, the universe does not break causality on a non-quantum scale. However, nothing in special relativity prevents a massless particle from always traveling the speed of light, i.e. a photon, nor from always traveling faster than light, i.e. a tachyon. And that is exactly what the math shows. By combining several of the equations of special relativity, the underlying relativistic symmetry between subluminal, luminal, and superluminal particles becomes clear. With regard to the superluminal, substituting relativistic mass for proper mass allows superluminal mass and energy to become definable, non-imaginary properties. This provides us with our current model of physical space. Figure 1. Figure 1, positive energy versus velocity. Here, the V equals C asymptote vertical represents the fluidic space-time membrane, which has a negligible but non-zero thickness. By examining this graph, a number of things will become immediately and intuitively clear. First, that just as a subluminal particle can never reach the speed of light, C, neither can a superluminal particle. In normal STL space, expending energy, e.g. shooting propellant out the back of your spaceship, can move you closer to the speed of light. So too in FTL space. However, in FTL space, the speed of light is the slowest possible speed, not the fastest, and you can never quite slow down to it, not as long as you possess mass. Since increasing speed moves you away from C in FTL,
There is no upper limit to tachyonic speeds, although there are practical limits given the minimal level of energy needed to maintain particle integrity. Remember, less energy equals more speed in superluminal space. And while rest mass in subluminal space is real, positive, and increases due to special relativity as V approaches C, in luminal space, rest mass is zero and V always equals C. And in superluminal space, rest mass is imaginary at V equals C, but becomes real, positive, and decreases when moving faster than C. An implication of this is the reversal of time dilation effects with regard to acceleration. In both STL and FTL, as one approaches C, one ages slower with regard to the larger universe. That is, the universe will age far faster than a spaceship barreling along at 99% of C. However, in FTL, approaching C means slowing down. If instead one speeds up, traveling at ever higher multiples of C, you would age faster and faster compared to the rest of the universe. This, of course, would be a major disadvantage of FTL travel if ships weren't encased in a Markov bubble when superluminal. More on this later. As one can see in the graph, it is possible to have a velocity of zero in subluminal space. What does this mean when motion is relative? That you are at rest with regard to whatever reference point you choose, whether that be an outside observer or the destination you wish to travel to. A velocity of zero in subluminal space translates to around 1.7 C in superluminal space. Fast, but still slower than the velocities of many FTL particles. Indeed, even low-end Markov drives are capable of 51.1 C. Nevertheless, if you need to reach a destination as quickly as possible, it can be worth the delta V to bring your spaceship to a complete stop with regard to your destination before transitioning to FTL in order to get that extra 1.7 C of velocity. Were it possible to directly convert subluminal mass into superluminal mass without a Markov bubble, 1.7 C would be the highest possible speed achievable, as there is no practical way to further accelerate the mass, i.e., further reduce the energy state of said mass, aside from chilling it. One can't suck propellant into your tanks, for example. This would be the second major disadvantage of FTL travel, again, if not for the use of a Markov bubble. The third disadvantage would be the fact that matter in superluminal space behaves radically different than in subluminal space, to the point where life as we know it would be impossible to sustain. This, again, is circumvented via the Markov bubble. The three different continua, the subluminal, the luminal, and superluminal, coexist within the same time and space, overlapping at every point in the universe. The luminal exists in a fluidic membrane that separates the subluminal from the superluminal, acting as an interference medium between them. The membrane is semipermeable and has a definite surface on both sides upon which all EM forces exist. The membrane itself, and thus the entirety of three-dimensional space, is made up of transluminal energy quanta, TEQs, which are, quite simply, the most fundamental building block of reality. A quantized entity, TEQs possess Planck length of 1, Planck energy of 1, and a mass of 0. Their movements and interactions give rise to every other particle and field. Figure 2, simplified diagram of spacetime. Taken as a whole, TEQs and spacetime itself behave in a quasi-fluidic way. Like a fluid, the luminal membrane exhibits pressure, density and compressibility, viscoelasticity, surface and surface tension. We will examine each of these in detail later, but for now, it's worth noting that viscoelasticity is the property that gives rise to gravity and inertia, and is what allows for all relative motion. As mass accumulates, it begins to displace the space-time membrane, which thins beneath the object. This is gravity. Likewise, the membrane resists change, which means it takes time to displace when force is applied. The viscousness of space-time results in friction between boundary layers, which is the reason for the lens-Thuring effect, aka frame dragging. Since subluminal and superluminal space are physically separated by the space-time membrane, STL mass and FTL mass can occupy the same coordinate points simultaneously, although this arrangement would be short-lived as A, all matter in superluminal space moves at some speed faster than C, and B, the shared membrane means that the space-time displacement from mass, which is to say, gravity, has an equal and opposite effect on the opposing realm. An example to illustrate. In STL space, a planet will press down upon the fabric of space-time to create the sort of gravity well we're all familiar with. At the same time, that depression will manifest in FTL space as a gravity hill, and equal and opposite prominence in the space-time fabric. And the reverse is also true. This has a number of consequences, first of which is that mass in one realm of space has a repulsive effect in the other. Stars, planets, and other STL gravitational bodies no longer act as attractors when one transitions to FTL, quite the opposite. The same is true of mass in superluminal space. However, since FTL contains a lower net energy density, a natural side effect of tachyons possessing a base speed of greater than c, and given the radically different laws and particles that exist in FTL, what happens is that the gravity hills produced by the denser subluminal matter scatter the tachyonic mass, forcing it out and away. As confirmed by Olert, 2122, the majority of our local superluminal matter exists in a vast halo surrounding the Milky Way. This halo provides positive pressure on the Milky Way, which helps keep the galaxy from flying apart. The gravitational effects of superluminal mass on our own subluminal realm were long a mystery. Early attempts to explain them resulted in the now obsolete theories of dark matter and dark energy. These days, we know that the concentrations of superluminal mass between the galaxies are responsible for the ongoing expansion of the universe, and that they also affect the shape and movement of the galaxies themselves. Whether or not tachyonic matter coalesces into the superluminal equivalent of stars and planets remains an open question. The math says yes, but so far, observational confirmation has proven elusive. The rim of the galaxy is too far away for even the fastest drones to reach, and our current generation of FTL sensors aren't sensitive enough to pick out individual gravitational bodies at that distance. No doubt that will change in time, and we will eventually be able to learn far more about the nature of superluminal matter. Another consequence of the well hill caused by mass-induced space-time displacement is the effect commonly known as the Markov limit. Before that can be explained, it will be helpful to conduct a quick review of how FTL travel and communication actually work. In order to have unlabored transition from subluminal to superluminal space, it is necessary to directly manipulate the underlying space-time membrane. This is done via a specially conditioned EM field that couples with the membrane, or rather with the constituent TEQs. In gauge theory, ordinary EM fields can be described as abelian, that is, the nature of the field differs from whatever generates it. This is true not only of EM radiation, but also electron-proton attraction and also repulsion within atoms and molecules. Non-abelian fields would be those such as the strong and weak nuclear forces. They are structurally more complicated and, as a result, display higher levels of internal symmetry. The other, more relevant, non-abelian fields are those associated with the surface tension, viscoelasticity, and internal coherence of the space-time membrane. These arise from the internal motions and interactions of the TEQs, the details of which far exceed the scope of this section. In any case, it has proven possible to convert ordinary EM radiation from abelian to non-abelian by modulating the polarization of the wave energy emitted from antennas or apertures, or by tuning the frequencies of alternating current to the toroidal geometries through which the currents are driven. This is the method used by a Markov drive. Doing so results in EM radiation with an underlying field of special unity group 2, symmetry and non-abelian form as described in Maxwell's expanded equations. This couples in an orthogonal direction with the space-time fields via a shared quantity, the A-vector potential. Orthogonal, as tardions and tachyons exhibit opposite motion directions along their packet lengths, and the conditioned EM field is interacting with both the subluminal and superluminal surfaces of space-time. This has often been described as traveling in a straight line along a right angle. Once the EM field is coupled with the space-time fabric, it becomes possible to manipulate the density of the medium. By injecting an appropriate amount of energy, space-time itself can be made increasingly thin and permeable. So much so that at a certain point, the energy density of subluminal space causes the affected area to pop up into superluminal space, like a high-pressure bubble expanding, rising into an area of lower pressure. As long as the conditioned EM field is maintained, the encompassed subluminal space can be kept suspended within superluminal space. From the point of view of an STL observer, everything within the bubble has vanished and can only be detected by its gravitational hill from the other side of the space-time membrane.
From inside the bubble, an observer will see themselves surrounded by a perfect spherical mirror where the surface of the bubble interfaces with the outer FTL space. From the point of view of an FTL observer, a perfectly spherical, perfectly reflective bubble will have just popped into existence in superluminal space. Mass and momentum remain conserved throughout. Your original heading will be the same in FTL as in STL, and your original speed will be converted to the superluminal energy equivalent. Once the EM field is discontinued, the bubble will vanish, and everything inside will drop back into subluminal space, a process no doubt familiar to many of you. Often this is accompanied by a bright flash and a burst of thermal energy as the light and heat that built up inside the bubble during the trip are released. A few points on the specific features of Markov bubbles are worth mentioning. Since the surface of the bubble acts as a perfect mirror, it is nearly impossible to shed waste heat from a spaceship during an FTL flight. This is why it becomes necessary to put crews and passengers into cryo prior to the trip. Given that, it is impractical to run a fusion drive while in FTL. Thus, Markov drives, which require a not inconsiderable amount of power to generate and maintain a conditioned EM field of sufficient strength, rely upon stored antimatter to produce said power. This is more efficient and results in the least amount of waste heat. Although a Markov drive and the spaceship around it contain a large amount of compressed energy by FTL standards, the only energy that superluminal space sees is that which appears via the surface of the bubble. Thus, the more efficient a Markov drive, i.e. the less energy it uses to generate the conditioned EM field, the faster you can travel. Were one unfortunate enough to collide with a chunk of FTL mass, this would result in immediate disruption of the Markov bubble and immediate return to STL space, with possible catastrophic consequences depending on one's location. The less energy you use to generate a Markov bubble, the increasingly delicate the bubble becomes. Large gravitational hills, such as those around stars and planets, are more than strong enough to disrupt the bubble and dump you back into normal subluminal space. This is what is known as the Markov limit. With adequate computational powers, the limit can be lowered, but it cannot be removed entirely. Currently, Markov drives cannot be activated in a gravitational field stronger than 1/100,000th G. This is why, in Sol, spaceships have to fly out to a distance equivalent to the radius of Jupiter's orbit before they're able to go FTL. Although if you're actually near Jupiter, you'll have to fly out even farther still. As annoying as the Markov limit is, no one likes having to sit through several more days of travel after weeks or months in cryo. It has actually proven to be a good thing. Because of it, no one can drop an FTL asteroid directly onto a city, or worse. Were there no Markov limit, every spaceship would be far more of a potential threat than they already are, and defense against surprise attacks would be basically impossible. We are also fortunate that the viscoelasticity of space-time precludes superpositional bombs. If a ship in FTL space flies over a mass in STL space that produces less than 1/100,000th G, and the ship returns to subluminal space at that precise moment, the ship and the mass will push each other apart with equal force, preventing either object from intersecting. If they did intersect, the resulting explosion would be on par with an antimatter detonation. Once a spaceship has entered superluminal space, straight-line flight is usually the most practical choice. However, a limited amount of maneuverability is possible by carefully increasing the energy density on one side or another of the bubble. This will cause that side of the spaceship to slow, and thus the vessel as a whole to turn. But it is a gradual process and only suitable for small course corrections over long distances. Otherwise, you risk destabilizing the bubble. For more substantial changes, it's better to drop back into subluminal space, reorient, and try again. Any changes in heading that occur in FTL will be reflected upon returning to STL. Likewise, any changes to total momentum, speed, with the degree of change being inversely proportional. Technically, it is possible for two ships in FTL to dock, but the practical difficulties of matching exact velocities, as well as the mathematics of merging Markov bubbles, means that while it has been done with drones, no one, to our knowledge, has been crazy enough to try it with crewed ships. Although a ship within a Markov bubble can never directly observe its FTL surroundings, some level of sensory information is possible. By pulsing the bubble at the appropriate frequencies, FTL particles can be created on the outer surface of the membrane, and these can be used both as a form of radar as well as a signaling mechanism. With careful measurement, we can detect the return of the particles when they impinge upon the bubble.
and this allows us to interact with superluminal space, albeit in a crude manner. This is the same method by which FTL comms and sensors work. Both may be used far closer to a star or planet than one can maintain a Markov bubble, but as with the bubble, there is a point at which the associated gravity hills become too steep for all but the slowest, most energetic FTL signals to climb. Due to the protection of the bubble, a ship retains the internal frame of reference it had prior to FTL, which means it does not experience the extreme time dilation that an exposed superluminal particle would, nor does it experience any relativistic effects at all. The twins of the famous twin paradox will age at the same rate if one of them takes an FTL flight from Sol to Alpha Centauri and back. This, of course, leads us to the question of causality. Why, one might ask, doesn't FTL travel allow for time travel, as all the equations for special relativity seem to indicate? The answer is that it doesn't. And we know this because it doesn't. Although that may seem facetious, the truth is that the debate remained unsettled until Robinson and the crew of the Daedalus made the first FTL flights. It took empirical experimentation to answer the question of time travel for certain, and it was only after the fact that the supporting math and physics were fully developed. What was found was this. No matter how fast a superluminal voyage, no matter how many multiples of C your spaceship travels, you will never be able to return to your origin point before you left. Nor, for that matter, can you use FTL signals to send information into the past. Some amount of time will always elapse between departure and return. How is this possible? If one is at all familiar with light cones and Lorentz transformations, it should be blindingly obvious that exceeding the speed of light results in being able to visit the past and kill your own grandfather, or something equally absurd. Yet we cannot. The key to understanding this lies in the fact that all three luminal realms belong to the same universe. Despite their seeming separation, as it appears from our normal subluminal point of view, the three are part of a larger cohesive whole. And while local violations of physical laws may appear to occur in certain circumstances, on a global scale, those laws are upheld. Conservation of energy and momentum, for example, are always maintained across the three luminal realms. Adding to that, there is a certain amount of crossover. Gravitational distortions on one side of the luminal barrier will have a mirrored effect on the other. Thus, an object moving in subluminal space will leave an STL gravitational distortion in the equivalent FTL space. Waves from the distortion will propagate outward at C, no matter what. But the movement of the gravitational center will be less than C. And the reverse is true for superluminal gravitational mass, which would leave an FTL track of space-time ripples through normal subluminal space. Of course, no such FTL tracks were detected prior to the invention of the Markov drive, but that was the result of, in most cases, their extreme weakness and the distance of most superluminal matter from the main body of the Milky Way. Note, it's important to remember that just as anything moving faster than C in subluminal space could theoretically be used to arrange a causality violation, so too could anything moving slower than C in superluminal space. In FTL, C is the minimum speed of information. Above that, relativity and non-simultaneity are maintained, no matter how fast you might be going. Even without the existence of a Markov drive, we now have a situation where natural phenomena seem to be violating the light speed barrier on both sides of the space-time membrane, but again, without inducing any causality violations. The question returns, why is that? The answer is twofold. One, no particle of real mass ever breaks the light speed barrier in either the sub- or superluminal realm. If one did, we would see all of the paradoxes and causality violations predicted by traditional physics. 2. Just as TEQs form the basis for every subluminal particle, they also form the basis for every superluminal particle. As their name implies, TEQs are capable of existing in all three realms at once, and they are capable of moving as slow as the slowest STL particle and as fast as the fastest FTL particle, which is very fast indeed, limited only by the lower boundary of energy needed to maintain particle coherence. And even then, TEQs can move faster still given their Planck energy of 1. Thus, with the discovery of TEQs, we have an object that is capable of conveying information far faster than the speed of light. Normally, this only occurs in the superluminal realm,
but any TEQ is capable of such speeds, as they often transfer from subluminal to superluminal velocities as their position within the space-time membrane changes. These changes are responsible for much of the quantum weirdness seen at small scales. The light cone, as it were, of an observer using TEQs for informational gathering would be far, far wider than if they were only using photons, wider but not complete. TEQs have a finite velocity. The wider light cone, or TEQ cone, expands the total set of events that can be regarded as simultaneous. Although non-simultaneity and relativity are maintained throughout all three luminal realms, when considered as a whole, the immense velocity of TEQs reduces the events that can be considered non-simultaneous to a far smaller number, and those that are lie outside the fastest speed of an FTL particle. And while, in theory, the universe remains fundamentally relative, in practice, the vast majority of events may be regarded as ordered and casual. That means that when a ship goes to FTL, it cannot induce any causality violations within superluminal space, as the Markov bubble is a superluminal particle object and behaves as such. And when a ship drops back to STL, no causality violations occur because travel times are always slower than the top speed of the TEQs, i.e. the speed of information. Where a paradox would have occurred in subluminal space, events are found to have proceeded in a causal relationship, one after another, without any contradiction. From a distance, it may appear that one can send a piece of information back to its origin point before it was transmitted, but appears is the word to keep in mind. In actuality, no such thing is possible. If one tries, the return transmission will never arrive any sooner than one unit of TEQ Planck time, where TEQ Planck time is defined as the length of time for a TEQ at maximal speed to traverse one unit of Planck length. As a result, whenever one sees the possibility for a causal violation in subluminal space, one is, in essence, seeing a mirage. And whenever one tries to exploit said possibility, one will fail. This renders a large number of observations in our subluminal universe illusionary. Prior to the invention of the Markov drive, or, failing that, detection of FTL gravitational signals, none of this mattered. Relativity was maintained throughout because FTL traveling communications weren't possible, nor could we accelerate a spaceship to high enough relativistic speeds to really begin to investigate the issue. Only now, with access to both the sub- and superluminal realms, has the truth become clear. As the light signatures of our modern-day FTL trips begin to reach the nearby stars, an observer positioned there with a powerful enough telescope would see a confusing series of images as ships and signals pop out of nowhere, seemingly out of order. However, by observing TEQs instead of photons, the true order of events may be established, or by physically traveling to the sources of the images. The exact mechanism that prevents causality violations in STL space is the top velocity of the TEQs. As long as that isn't broken, and no known mechanism would allow for this, FTL would never allow for time travel into the past. And for that, we should be grateful. A non-causal universe would be sheer chaos. With our overview finished, we will now examine the theoretical possibility of using conditioned EM fields to reduce inertial effects and to lessen or increase perceived gravity. Although as yet impractical with our current levels of antimatter production, in the future, this could be a means of... Appendix 2. Ship-based combat in space. Transcribed from Professor Chung's lecture at the UMC Naval Academy, Earth, 2242. Good afternoon, cadets. Be seated. Over the next 6 weeks, you'll receive the finest education the UMC can muster on the means and methods of ship-based combat. Fighting in space isn't twice as hard as fighting in air or water. It isn't three or four times as hard. It's an entire order of magnitude more difficult. Zero-G is a non-intuitive environment for the human brain. Even if you grew up on a ship or station, as some of you have, there are aspects of inertial maneuvering you will not understand without proper instruction. And no matter how sharp you might be when it comes to good old slower-than-light, FTL throws those rules out the airlock and stomps on them until they're a bloody mess. The maneuvering capabilities of your vessel and those you fight alongside will determine where you can fight, who you can fight, and, if needed, the requirements of retreat. Space, as has often been stated, is not only large,
It's larger than you can imagine. If you can't close the distance between you and your target, they are invulnerable to your fire. This is why it is often advantageous to drop out of FTL with a high degree of relative motion, but not always. Circumstances vary, and as officers, you will be called upon to make those sorts of judgment calls. You will learn the capabilities and limitations of our fusion drives. You will learn why, despite what you may have seen in games or movies, the concept of personal combat space vessels is not only outdated, it never was a thing. A drone or missile is not only cheaper, it is far more effective. Machines can withstand far more Gs than any human. Yes, on occasion you get a radicalized miner or local cartel member who uses a smaller spaceship for piracy or the like, but when confronted with a proper warship such as our new cruisers or battleships, they always lose. When you do engage the enemy, combat will be a strategic interplay between the different systems of your ships. A chess game, where the goal is to inflict enough damage on the hostiles to disable or destroy them before they do the same to you. Every weapon system we use has different advantages and disadvantages. Missiles are best for short to medium range attacks, but they're too slow and carry too little fuel for longer range engagements. And once you fire them, they're gone. Point defense lasers can stop incoming missiles, but only a certain number and only until the laser overheats. Kasaba howitzers are also short to medium range weapons, but unlike missiles, lasers can't stop them once they're fired. In fact, nothing short of a solid wall of lead and tungsten 10 or 20 meters thick is going to stop the radiation beam from a Kasaba howitzer. The downside is their mass. You can only carry so many Kasaba howitzers in your ship magazine. Also, at long range, the beam from a howitzer will widen, leaving it about as powerful as a wet fart in a blizzard. Medium to long range, you rely on your keel laser. But again, you have to worry about overheating, and your enemy can counter with chalk and chaff to disperse the incoming pulse. Mass drivers and nuke-powered penetrators can be used at any distance, as kinetic weapons have effectively infinite range in space, but they're really only practical in close-range engagements where the enemy doesn't have time to evade, or long, long-range attacks where the enemy doesn't know you're shooting at them. No matter which weapon or weapons you choose to employ, you will have to balance their use with your ship's maximum thermal load. Do you fire your keel laser one more time, or do you execute another evasion burn? Do you risk extending your radiators during a firefight in order to shed a few extra BTUs? How long can you risk cooling down before jumping to FTL if the enemy's chasing you? Ship-to-surface combat has different requirements than ship-to-ship. Stationary installations such as orbital defense platforms, HAB rings, and converted asteroids all require unique strategies. If you choose to board an enemy vessel, how best to protect your troops as well as your own ship? Along with physical combat, you will have to contend with electronic warfare. The hostiles will be trying to subvert your computer systems and turn them against you. Jamming may not protect you, as the hostiles could use a line of sight beam to initiate a system handshake. All these things and more must be taken into account when engaging in space combat. The environment wants to kill you. The hostiles want to kill you. And your own instincts and lack of knowledge will kill you, and everyone around you, if you don't master these fundamentals. Now, some of you are thinking, won't the ship mind or our pseudo-intelligences handle most of these things? The answer is yes, they will. But not all the time. A ship mind doesn't have hands. What they can move or fix is limited, and that goes double for pseudo-intelligences. In an emergency, some things can only be done by a human. And there have been numerous cases where the ship mind or the ship's computer system has been disabled by enemy action. When that happens, these decisions will fall to you, the next generation of UMCN officers. The next 6 weeks will be some of the hardest 6 weeks of your lives. That's by design. The UMC doesn't want anyone who is unqualified to step onto a spaceship where they can endanger not only their own lives, but the lives of their fellow crew. Better that you wash out now and go back to being swabbies who only have to worry about keeping their boots polished and their jaws off the deck. If you don't think you can handle this sort of responsibility, get up and leave. The door's right there, and no one, not me, not your superiors, and not the UMC will think any less of you for walking out now. No? All right, then. Over the next month and a half, my staff and I are going to put you through the ringer. You will wish you gave up. But if you do the hours, work hard, and learn from the mistakes of those who paid for their knowledge with blood and lives, then you have a good chance of wearing your officer's pips, wearing them, and doing justice to them. So study hard, and at the end of this program, I expect each and every one of you to impress me with your knowledge of space-based combat. That will be all. Dismissed.